So we are in 2 Samuel. Last week we finished chapter 3, which will of course take us to chapter 4 tonight. And what's going on, to sort of quickly recap, is Saul has died. And David is in the process of consolidating his kingdom. In fact, he's in the process of being anointed as king over Israel. Now, David has a promise. He was anointed by Samuel and was told that he was going to be king. Of course, he had multiple opportunities to make that happen quickly when Saul was unguarded. And in no case did he harm Saul. So when Saul finally dies, the way is now clear for him. And both Saul and David know that David is going to be king. And I said this last time, I don't know whether David is extremely cunning or whether he has just sort of got a natural talent for politics. They look the same. You can't tell the difference. It may be that he is very good at calculating, or it may be that he's just naturally good at it. I certainly don't know. But he is somebody who has managed to gather people around him. He was a commander in Saul's army for a while until Saul went full-blown paranoid. So people know that he has a track record as a commander. And when he was fleeing from Saul, he gathered around himself some 600 men that were quite happy to serve with him and to be under his leadership. So he's a natural leader, and he is naturally charismatic. It is also the case that he may be a natural politician. Or as I say, he may have studied Machiavelli before Machiavelli was born. But in either case, he exhibits very sure-footed decisions when it comes to uniting Israel and getting them to declare him as king. You remember from last time that Abner set up Ishbosheth, who is one of Saul's sons, as king over what would eventually become the northern kingdom. Abner was the commander of Saul's army. Jonathan is dead. Ishbosheth is the heir apparent. And Abner sets him up in Mahanaim. And of course, I mentioned last time, Mahanaim was on the other side of the Jordan. And that's the place where Jacob met his brother on returning from Haran. It will also be the place where David is going to flee to when Absalom stages a coup. Very rough country, very difficult to get people in and out of. And so if you want to mount a rebellion and not get swept off your feet, Mahanaim is where you go, because you're really hard to dig out. So then Abner got crosswise with Ishbosheth, because Abner took one of Saul's concubines, and Ishbosheth says, "What are you doing?" And Abner says, "What do you mean, what am I doing? You're going to chastise me over this woman?" And so he then begins to plot against Ishbosheth and make arrangements to unify Israel and cut Ishbosheth out. He runs afoul of Joab. Joab is David's commander, and we'll see more of Joab tonight, by the way. Joab is a thug. He's power hungry. I was watching a lecture from Hillsdale, and this guy said something to the effect, the last thing you want to do is get between Joab and power, because Joab will run right over you. So Joab kills Abner, and that's where we finished. And David has made some very sure-footed moves. So when an Amalekite came and told David that he had killed Saul, David executed him. Didn't want to be any part of that. And when Abner got killed by Joab, David mourns. And by the way, Abner's killing of Joab is technically legal, because Joab had killed Ashiel, Joab's brother. So what Joab did is lured him down to Hebron, which is a city of refuge, and then said, "We need to go talk." And they walked along, and as soon as they went out of the gate, Joab turns around and stabs him. So Joab is the avenger of blood for Ashiel, his brother. So technically it's not murder. David, however, laments and says that Joab avenged the blood that was shed in war, and he should not have done that. But the point is, David is distancing himself from anything that would cast him in a bad light with respect to the northern kingdom. He disavows any desire to kill Saul. So nobody can say that David conspired somehow to kill him. He also disavows Joab's killing of Abner for the same reason. And what we're going to have tonight is Ishbosheth, Saul's son, is going to be murdered, and David will once again do the politically deft thing. Now, as I said at the beginning, he may just be really good at it, a very talented politician. I am not suggesting he's cynical, but you can't tell the difference. And when you're dealing with palace politics and so forth, sometimes hard to get around. So we're in chapter 4 now. When Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed, and all Israel was dismayed. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of one was Baana, and the name of the other Rechab, sons of Rimmon, a man of Benjamin from Beeroth, for Beeroth was also part of Benjamin. And the Beerothites fled to Gittim and have been sojourners there to this day. Remember, Saul is from Benjamin. So these are all fellow tribes members of Saul and Ishbosheth. Verse 4, Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. And as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame, and his name was Mephibosheth. We'll hear more about Mephibosheth later. It's a really neat story. We'll get to Mephibosheth in a couple of weeks. This is Jonathan's son, not Saul's son. And I sort of expect that what's going on is when Saul dies and Jonathan dies, his nursemaid sort of thinks, all right, somebody's going to murder this kid for protecting the line of... So she flees and in the process drops him and he becomes a cripple. Verse 5. Now the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, Rechab and Baana, set out, and about the heat of the day, they came to the house of Ishbosheth as he was taking his noonday rest. And they came into the midst of the house as if to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Baana, his brother, escaped. So they sneak in, they stab him, and they escape. Now, this is written awkwardly, at least in my translation. I don't know whether they fled and then later came back and said, oh, look what's happened, or whether all this happened at once. So they stabbed Ishbosheth as he was resting in his bed. Verse 7, when they came into the house as he lay on his bed in his bedroom, they struck him and put him to death and beheaded him. The way it reads here, they're sort of disjointed, not sure what's going on. The point is that they killed him and took his head. They took his head and went by way of the Arabah all night. Arabah, of course, is the Dead Sea. So they crossed from Mahanaim, crossed the Jordan at the Dead Sea, and are heading to Hebron, and brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. And they said to the king, here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord the king this day on Saul and on his offspring. But David answered Rechab and Baana, his brother, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity. When one told me, behold, Saul is dead, and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which is the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed, shall I not require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth? David commanded his young men, and they killed them and cut off their hands and feet and hanged them outside the pool at Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron. So again, people are misreading David. They are thinking that this will get them a reward. And the other thing that is particularly heinous about this is they are Benjaminites. And one of the things David has done very carefully is to avoid antagonizing Benjamin and to avoid doing anything that would get people who liked Saul, who was a Benjaminite, to think somehow David was responsible for anything that had to do with Saul. So he's been very careful about that. And when these Benjaminites show up with the head of the heir, he obviously has them killed. These are all what I would call very deft political moves. And none of them are at David's instigation. He doesn't start any of this. He didn't send Saul to war, so he has no responsibility for Saul's death. He didn't bring Abner down with the intention of killing him. In fact, Abner came down. They had a parley. Abner was on his way back home when Joab was the one that called him back. And then finally, he didn't have anything to do with the murder of Ishbosheth. Chapter 5. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and flesh. In times past, when Saul was king over us, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you, 'You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel.'" Now, I don't know how they know that, other than perhaps Samuel may have let it be known, but obviously it is. Verse 3. So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. And David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. At Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and at Jerusalem he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. One of the things that you might sort of tuck away is notice that he begins his ministry at the age of 30. He is Yeshua's ancestor, and the idea of beginning your life's work, if you will, at the age of 30. I just find the number interesting. It's nothing more than that. Now, verse 6. I'm going to read this both out of 2 Samuel and out of 1 Chronicles because they're slightly different. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who said to David, "You will not come in here, but the blind and the lame will ward you off," thinking David cannot come in here. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David, and David said on that day, "Whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him get up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind who are hated by David's soul." So the Jebusites say, "We are so well fortified that we could man the place with the lame and the blind and we could still repulse your attack." It's trash talk. So David, of course, comes in, and there's apparently a water shaft that feeds the city, and he has his men go up the water shaft to get into the city and take it from inside. That's what happens. The interesting thing about this is David takes Jerusalem with his mighty men. That's why it's called the City of David, because David took it with his own guys. It has always then been known as the City of David. So verse 9, "And David lived in the stronghold and called it the City of David. And David built the city all around from the Milo outward. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, was with him." Now, the city of David is a small part of Jerusalem. Greater Jerusalem is much bigger. The city of David is, I believe, just down from the Western Wall, which is the last remaining thing standing from the temple. So the city of David and the Milo are down there, and then Jerusalem is actually much larger. So now let's swing over to 1 Chronicles 11, verse 4. This one is slightly different. In 2 Samuel, it says, "The king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites." Here it says, "David and all Israel went to Jerusalem," that is Jebus, "where the Jebusites were, the inhabitants of the land. The inhabitants of Jebus said to David, 'You will not come in here.' Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. David said, 'Whoever strikes the Jebusites first shall be chief and commander.' And Joab," here we are again, "and Joab, son of Zeruiah, went up first. So he became chief. And David lived in the stronghold before it was called the city of David. And he built the city all around from the Milo outward in a complete circuit. And Joab repaired the rest of the city. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord of hosts was with him." So a couple of differences. One, in 2 Samuel, It's very much like David and his henchmen, if you will. In 1 Chronicles, it's all Israel. And then in 1 Chronicles, we discover that Joab is the guy that leads the attack up the water shaft. The water shaft is not mentioned in 1 Chronicles. The water shaft is mentioned in 2 Samuel, but Joab is not. You got to put them together to find out what actually happened. So we're back in 2 Samuel chapter 5. And Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees, also carpenters and masons, who built David a house. And David knew that the Lord had established him king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. And David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he came from Hebron, and more sons and daughters were born to David. And these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem: Shammua, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, Ibthar, Elishua, Nephig, Japhia, Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet. The only one we're going to hear from again, of course, is Solomon. So, verse 17. Then when the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David. But David heard of it and went down to the stronghold. Now, the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. There's a river that runs parallel to the central ridge. And you go down from Jerusalem. There's a highway there today. And you drive down from Jerusalem toward the Mediterranean. And down at the bottom, you'll hit the valley of the Rephaim. So what the Philistines are doing is, obviously, having defeated Saul, they are not happy to see Israel reunited. And, of course, David has a reputation in addition to all that. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to come up to the central ridge and take the saddle of Benjamin, which is the central piece of key terrain in Israel, because you have north-south ridge route that goes up and down the spine of Israel, and then you have a cross compartment from the Jordan River over to the Mediterranean. So that's typically a place that sees a lot of action. Verse 19. And David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?" And the Lord said to David, "Go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand." And David came to Baal-perazim, and David defeated them there. And he said, "The Lord has burst through my enemies before me like a bursting flood." Therefore, the name of that place is called Baal-perazim. And the Philistines left their idols there, and David and his men carried them away. Baal-perazim means the Lord of bursting through. In fact, we'll see it again when David tries to move the ark. There you'll have Uzzah stick his hand out, and he'll have the place where he dies named after him bursting forth. So the Philistines left their idols there, and David and his men carried them away. And the manner of war at that time was, when we go to war, it's our gods against your gods. And if we prevail, our gods are stronger, and if you prevail, your gods are stronger. And you remember when they had the battle at Aphek back in 1 Samuel, when Eli was priest, the Israelites took the ark down there, and they lost. So the ark was then captured by the Philistines, and the Philistines took it in and brought it to their cities, and they decided very quickly they didn't want to do that. So they sent it back, and we'll see that again. So the idea that the Philistines are coming up there with their gods is perfectly normal in that whole thing. And of course, as it says here, the rout was so complete that Israel carried their gods away. Now, I have no idea what they did with them. Obviously, there's a fairly strict prohibition against idol worship. And when we're in the conquest of the land, under Joshua, one of the things that gets said is, do not desire their idols, because there are precious metals on them. Don't take that stuff. So for Israel to take the idols instead of just destroying them in place, I have no idea what's going on there. And we don't hear any more about it, so I have no more insight than that. 22. And the Philistines came up yet again, and spread out in the valley of Rephaim, same place. And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, "You shall not go up, but go around to their rear and come up against them opposite the balsam trees. And when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then rouse yourself, for then the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines." And David did as the Lord commanded and struck down the Philistines from Geba to Gezer. So they're up in the valley of Rephaim, and instead of attacking them directly, David circles around and gets between them and the Mediterranean. And when he hears them starting to move, he hits them while they're in march formation. In infantry warfare, the last thing that you want to do is hit an enemy that is dug in a prepared position, waiting for you. That's the worst possible thing you can do, because he's going to do as well as could possibly be done for him. So what they're doing is they are getting in position around behind him. They expect the Philistines to start marching up toward the Saddle of Benjamin. And when they hear them start to move, then you've got them moving as opposed to hunkered down in a defense. And so you hit them while they're moving as opposed to organized for defense. So you got the column of Philistines, they'll be strung out, they'll be moving and so forth. And if you come in then behind and on their flank, you get them in their most vulnerable situation. Chapter 6. David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000, and David rose and went with all the people who were with him to Baalah-Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of Hosts, who sits enthroned on the cherubim. And they carried the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which is on the hill. And Uzzah and Aho, the sons of Abinadab, were driving the new cart with the Ark of God, and Aho went before the Ark. So, mistake number one. God says nothing in the Torah about carrying the Ark on a cart. So what they're doing is they are copying what the Philistines did successfully. And I would suggest to you that the reason the Philistines didn't get struck down is because they were ignorant. They didn't know any better. And God wanted the Ark out of that place, so God put up with it. But you'll notice when some Israelites looked in the Ark, a whole bunch of them died. So the fact that it worked for the Philistines does not mean it's going to work for the Israelites, because the Israelites are supposed to know better. Verse 5. And David and all the house of Israel were making merry before the Lord with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. And when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah put out his hand to the Ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God struck him down because of his error, and he died there beside the Ark of God. And David was angry because the Lord had burst forth against Uzzah, and the place is now called Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the Ark of the Lord come to me?" So David was not willing to take the Ark of the Lord into the city of David, but David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. And the Ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. This is, if you will, a reprise of the incident with Nadab and Abihu, sons of Aaron. Big celebration. We're bringing the Ark of God forward. Everybody's dancing, and nobody means any disrespect whatsoever. This is an entirely joyous time. We're bringing the Ark of God. We're worshiping God. This is wonderful. Exactly the same attitude that Nadab and Abihu had when the presence of God came down on the tabernacle for the first time. Wow, this is really wonderful. Look at the presence of God. Let's go in and take some incense in there and let's worship Him. God said, no, that's not the way it's to be done. And God struck them down. God is doing exactly the same thing here. I don't care how happy you are. There's a way that this is supposed to be done, and you're either going to do it my way or it's not going to happen. Countless preachers have preached wonderful sermons on that, The more you know and the closer you are to God, the more important it is that you do it God's way. The Philistines can get away with a new cart because the Philistines got no idea. You can't because you're supposed to know better. The comment was that Yeshua does a parable of two servants, and one who knows the master's will and does not do it is punished more severely than the one who does wrong but doesn't know what he was supposed to do. So the same thing is going on here. The same thing happened with Nadab and Abihu. God says, the closer you are to me and the more you know, the more important it is for you to do it the way it's supposed to be done. Now, the other place you want to read about the same thing is in 1 Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 15. David built houses for himself in the city of David, and he prepared a place for the Ark of God and pitched a tent for it. Then David said that no one but the Levites may carry the Ark of God, for the Lord had chosen them to carry the Ark of the Lord and to minister to him forever. So the second time we're doing this, we're going to do it right. When we read the same thing in 2 Samuel, that detail is missing. So then back to 2 Samuel, verse 12. And it was told King David, the Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the Ark of God. So David went and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. And when those who bore the Ark of the Lord had gone six steps, he sacrificed an ox and a fatted animal. And David danced before the Lord with all his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of a horn. So the fact that they've got this thing being carried by the Levites and so forth is not in 2 Samuel. You have to read that in 1 Chronicles. It is not the case that we tried again with a new cart. He realized what the problem was and corrected it. As the Ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord. And she despised him in her heart. Now, remember, David is a musician. He's a poet. He's obviously a warrior and in good shape. And he's obviously a dancer. Remember, Michal now is the daughter of Saul. She is the daughter of the king. She's married to David. And the idea that David is not behaving himself with regal decorum bothers her. David last week had made a point to bring her back because when David ran away from Saul, Saul took Michal and married her off to somebody else. So when Saul died and David became king, he said, I want my wife back. And we remember that Michal loved David. And that's the only instance in the Hebrew scriptures where a woman is described as loving a man. Absolutely unique. And she goes up against her father. She helps him escape. So they parted, if you will, on loving terms. And it's been several years. And when he finally gets in a position to do so, he wants her back. So here she is. And she's the daughter of the king. And so she's looking at this as, wait a minute, that's not how a king should behave. Be far more dignified and regal than that. That's sort of what's going on. Verse 17, and they brought in the Ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And when David had finished offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts and distributed among all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both men and women, a cake of bread, a portion of meat, and a cake of raisins to each one. And all the people departed, each to his house. Big celebration, big feast, lots of animals slaughtered and so forth. Verse 20, and David returned to bless his household. He's on a high. He wants to come back into his house and bless them because he's finally got the Ark of God in his city. So David returned to bless his household, but Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, how the king of Israel honored himself today. Read that sarcastically. Sort of like when you're arguing with your wife and she says, fine, do what you want. She doesn't mean it. How the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself. Now, David is wearing an ephod. Now, I'm not sure what that means, but I sort of suspect that it's the long linen cloak that is worn under anything. The way I would describe that is David is not exposed. And for you ladies, to give you an example, if you are wearing a slip, it's really very modest. There's nothing visible. But you wouldn't go to King Supers in your slip. You just wouldn't do it. Not that anything untoward has been exposed, it's just you wouldn't do it. So what's happened here is not that David is sort of flashing a bit of thigh before the ladies. David is out there in his slip instead of out there in his royal robes being really dignified. 21. And David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord. And I will make merry before the Lord. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes, but by the female servants of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor." And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. Now, having said that, I don't know that Michal isn't barren. Because remember, she and David were married for a period of time before Saul went full paranoid. She has been the wife of another man for a number of years. So the fact that she has no children, I mean, it may be a comment on the fact that he never visited her again, or it just may be David didn't have any children with her either. Just don't know. I mean, obviously the way it sort of reads in context is, all right, babe, you go sleep in your room and I'll sleep in mine, and that'll be the end of it. But I don't know that that's what actually happened. I think she may have been barren anyway. So next, we're going to get God's covenant with David and continued consolidation. David winds up, by the way, owning everything from the Euphrates River down to Egypt. He builds quite a large kingdom that Solomon will inherit.